must be lights burning brighter somewhere. Got to be birds flying higher in a sky more blue. If I can dream of a better land where all my brothers walk hand in hand, tell me why. Understanding sometime, strong winds of promise that will blow away the doubt and fear. If I can dream of a warmer sun where hope keeps shining on everyone, tell me why.
Elvis. This is that request that was supposed to go up yesterday. I said I'd do it next Friday. Oh, I decided to do it today. So there's Elvis. It's a good song. It can be taken many ways, but I think if you take it our way, it's a great song. Insurgent Radio. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is White Aryan Resistance Radio. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, right here in the bunker, right here in north central Indiana. Yeah, we got an overcast day. It's cool out there. It's about 31 degrees, and it's starting to spit a little bit of something that may be snow. So I'm not sure what's going to happen today, but I think everything will turn out all right as long as you got the right attitude. And this is the 24th of January, almost to February, so if you got something important to do in January in 2015, you better do it because you'll never, ever get another chance. And we're right here by Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we sell only Ethel and Supreme here. Ethel and Regular, actually. Oh, we sell some kerosene, too. Hey, do you guys, any of you guys out there remember when we had to take a car in when it was getting past freezing in the wintertime and put alcohol in it? Yeah, alcohol. I remember my dad doing that. They had a little thermometer type thing. It wasn't a thermometer for heat or cold, but you put alcohol in your radiator until that thing, the needle come down there to about 10 below, Yeah, you could, and if you got real pissed off, you could drink the alcohol out of your radiator. That was lots of fun. You didn't care if you broke down, you drink that alcohol, you didn't care whether you ever got home. We are at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Get that address around. Scribble it on the walls, all that kind of stuff. And put resist.com up there, too. Okay, so anyhow, I told you, let's see, we got the money orders out to the prisoners. Yeah, we got that done. And what else? We got a bunch of email or snail mail out to some new prisoners that are writing in, and we always send them something. I got one that was in solitary confinement, wrote me yesterday, so he doesn't have any money or anything for stamps or anything to contribute, so we'll send him a book anyhow. For guys in solitary or just prison in general, I like Jack London's Star Rover. I think that's a fantastic book, and especially for somebody's in prison, because this prisoner is wrapped in a straitjacket made of steel almost all the time, and he's able to develop out-of-body experiences to travel back in history and all that kind of stuff. It's really a good book. If you haven't read Star Rover, you better get a hold of it. It's not that expensive. I think on eBay or Amazon, you'd probably get it for $10. Oh, yeah, yesterday I was talking about this this book, Operation Paperclip, where they brought all the German scientists, or as many as they could grab, over here to work on weapons of mass destruction and the space shot and all that kind of stuff. Well, I said, I'm not sure whether that gal's Jewish. Her name was Jacobson. Sure as hell, a lot of Jacobsons are Jewish, but I got a note from my good buddy down in Florida, and he says, "Hey, T.T., Amy Jacobson is Walter Jacobson's daughter, newscaster for Chicago TV for over 40 years. Yes, he's a Jew." I could tell by the way, I could almost tell by the way she was talking, because she was exaggerating, and then when she said that all the scientists in Germany were devoted to evil things, well, that was bullshit. They developed tremendous things during the Third Reich, the scientists did, you know. But that's the way you got to do. You just got to read between the lines. You can almost tell. And you can get a hell of a lot of good stuff out of bad articles if you read between the lines and know what to toss out and what to keep. Yeah, Obama wanted me to go over there and represent him with the Sheikh of Arab B that just bit and rolled a seven, that Saudi Arabian jerk. And you see, he knew where all the bodies were. And it's a shame that we have anything to do with Saudi Arabia. It's just the oil. It's just the oil. And our governments and presidents have been so intertwined with those people over the years that both sides got tremendous information. They could wipe each other out. I mean, it was such an incestuous situation. It was terrible. It was horrible. And it still is. And those bastards know about the 9/11. In fact, they probably were involved in it. So, anyhow. But I told Obama I can't go. I got other things to do. I got to take care of my radio club. So that's that. He was going to go over there to India and go to the Taj Mahal. What the hell's that got to do with diplomacy? I mean, that costs money. You imagine all the people he takes with him, or any president takes with him when they go around the world. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of people. Many, many, many big jet airliners and the whole bit. It's not just like old Tommy going across the street here to check out my neighbor's milk cow. I mean, it's expensive. Boy, old sniper's getting to be something. Boy, that's got the right and the left going at each other again. Yeah, right. You know, you don't notice how these right wingers and anything military, any amount of killing or anything is just okay. It's wonderful. They just don't want to remember that we illegally occupied Iraq, absolutely against the rules of war. And obviously, if the UN had any teeth, they'd have jumped into it. And the World Court and all that kind of stuff, these guys are all war criminals. But yet, anything that these Republicans say, anything our guys do over there in Iraq is okay. Well, that's like breaking into your neighbor's house, and then once he's in the house, he goes around and smashes all the furniture, right? First we illegally invade it, and then we tear up the country and shoot anybody gets in our way. That's criminal. That's absolutely, I mean, it's unbelievable how the Republican Party especially, and half the Democrat Party, go along with all this bullshit. Well, you know, over there in Britain, you can't say hardly anything, I guess. Or you can, or you should, and even go to jail for saying it. They're ragging on the right wing, but the right wing is talking about Britain first, Britain first, Britain first. They should say white Britain first, or whites first. And take the crap. If they throw me in jail for saying whites first, I'll go. That's just the way it is. Let's hear what the crappy press in Britain have to say about the far right, the far right.
Wrong language.
Terrorist scum!
Off our streets!
Taliban scum!
Off our streets!
This is Britain First, a small far-right anti-Islamist group, complete with paramilitary trappings. The man with the megaphone is Paul Golding, formerly of the BNP.
Off our streets!
Right, let's keep the convoy tight.
They have military Land Rovers.
Can the Land Rover get the Christian patrol leaflets ready, please? Roger.
Uniforms, walkie-talkies. We join them on what they called a Christian patrol. So we've just hooked up with the group Britain First. They haven't told us where they're going or what they're doing. All they've said is they're conducting three what they called operations this evening. They've given us this walkie-talkie to keep us informed about the operations and where they're going. They were set up last year after a small group of extremists called Muslim Patrol hit the headlines threatening people drinking outside mosques.
Pour it out. Get him to pour it out.
Britain First's modus operandi. Dressing up as soldiers and dangerous publicity stunts. They've invaded mosques across the country, this one in East London.
Okay, if he's not here, I'm going to leave you some of this literature.
Some Muslim leaders have called for them to be proscribed.
ETA, 1 minute, get ready to disembark.
ETA, 1 minute. The drama mounting. It's all getting suitably menacing.
Get the flags, the PA system, the microphone, get the whole lot, and the leaflets.
Then, at high speed...
Here, get this, yeah?
Yeah, I know, get in there.
They drive straight into a car park barrier, taking it clean off its concrete pillars.
Yeah, you will, bloody minute. Tell you what, it's too heavy. It'll take a few of us.
Can you not film this?
Oh, sorry, man. Sorry.
A far-right dad's army hitting the buffers is, of course, a bit funny. But it's symbolic as well. In the car park of politics, the British public never seem to let the far-right find a space. After the car park to the house of radical preacher Anjem Chowdhury. Then to the home of Islamist radical Abu Izzedine, who's been convicted of terrorist-related offences.
This is English soil. The people down this road do not want you here.
Most people on the street were ambivalent. Some weren't.
We are your host. You are our guests. You don't shit on us. We're the hand that feeds you at the end of the day.
The Paul Goldings, Tommy Robinsons and Nick Griffins will come and go. What's more interesting, the backroom people who remain constant. People like Jim Dowson and his marketing company Midas. He doesn't normally do television interviews, prefers to stay behind the scenes. His CV: ex-Calvinist minister, organiser of Belfast flag protests. He cut his marketing teeth working for the militant pro-life movement in the States, then set up the BNP's fundraising call centre in Belfast.
You've got to remember, most political parties don't know their arse to their elbow. You bring in a professional marketing team. You know, I trained in America with the pro-lifers and all that. If you apply professional marketing techniques and fundraising to a political situation, it's a gift.
Yeah.
It's a gift.
Yeah.
And that's what we did with the BNP. Raised them £4 million, and then left them to it. I was never in the BNP, but we did do work for them, just to make them successful enough to push everybody over to the right. And I think that has resulted now in the success that UKIP is enjoying. And far better UKIP enjoy it than the BNP, to be honest with you. But at least everybody's over to the right a couple of notches.
Now he's bankrolling Britain First.
How much would you say you've ploughed into that?
I know, that would be difficult to count. I'd need to go and calculate that up. But a substantial amount. One thing I agree with Mr. Chowdhury in, there is such a concept as a just war, a holy war. He calls it jihad, we call it crusade.
Is that how you see it? You see yourself involved in a holy war?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Without any shadow of a doubt.
Like your rhetoric is identical to theirs in that respect, isn't it?
It maybe is, but we are right, they're wrong.
Do you think Jesus would do what you're doing?
Absolutely.
Because it wasn't his modus operandi in the New Testament, was it? We have no record of him driving around Jerusalem in a decommissioned military...
But he also said, I come not to bring peace but a sword.
Jim Dowson and Britain First are employing sophisticated social media techniques in this crusade. But first, puppies.
Britain First's Facebook page gets about 2 million interactions a day, which is phenomenal. But what proportion of those people are just people who like puppies? Britain First has a team of people pumping out Facebook pages with these types of images on them. The puppy is the hook. But then when you click through, you get back to Britain First's home page. The new crusade begins.
The numbers online are impressive. The numbers they can get down the gym for Fight Club, less so.
The size of the organisation isn't what we're concerned about. It's their ability to draw people into conflict, their ability to drill people and educate people in preparation for what they think is going to be like some kind of great Armageddon or the final battle.
Some want them banned. In a democracy, of course, it's more complicated. Alan Johnson was Home Secretary during the EDL's formative years. We started by asking him how close they came to being proscribed.
Oh, they came nowhere near.
Nowhere.
English Defence League came nowhere near that, no. No. I mean, I'm on the left of British politics, but, you know, I can't challenge their reason to exist. There was never anything that, although we kept an eye on them, there was never anything that suggested that they were crossing that line.
If you were Home Secretary, what advice, what would you be doing about Britain First?
I'd be keeping a careful eye on them, as I'm sure the Home Secretary is doing. I would ask for, so this is a very new group, a very small group, so it means you want to be absolutely sure that they're registering on the radar.
And they are. Before we arrived at our final stop, the police had arrived.
We're going to go down past East London Mosque and going to do a right into Brick Lane.
Down Brick Lane?
There were some typically British reactions to them. Irony.
What's your idea?
Christian patrol, sir.
Oh, so we're going to go down the non-Christian street.
Okay. Rude gestures.
I don't feel like it's right.
This man was even apologising to Asian people.
It was interesting that you kind of personally took it upon yourself to kind of almost apologise.
Others took more personal offence.
So even though it started all sort of quite farcical, this of course is how it ended up. A flashpoint of tension here on Brick Lane. There are young people coming from all around. They're obviously very angry. Some community leaders have showed up to try and calm things down. And, of course, quite a big police presence suddenly on the scene.
If it hadn't been for that lightning-fast police response, the situation would have seriously disintegrated. Britain First were escorted away. They reconvened in another car park later.
For defenders of England, you scarpered pretty quick.
We never scarpered pretty quick. I mean, that's your opinion. I mean, we still carried on marching up the road. Police asked us if we'd get in the vehicles and go. We abided by what the police said.
We don't want to stir up tensions, but if we have to stir up tensions in order to get the issues addressed, then we will. We're here to pressurise the Muslim community to take care of certain issues.
The day ended as it began, in a car park, with people who feel like someone else is always stealing their space.
You know, this is like going back, for me, at least 25, 30 years. This is the same stuff we did over and over and over and over. And it's, it won't go anywhere. It never does. It just gets a lot of press and maybe makes people feel good. Maybe they get to punch a non-white in the nose or something. But it doesn't go anywhere. And meanwhile, all these people are exposing themselves to the government and the police, make their lists and so forth. So this, just like here in the United States, you can't win that way. Now, I would advise, you heard the guy who was in the government talking about he's on the left. Well, I say the intelligent, sharp guys that have been called right-wingers pick the good issues on the left and invade the left. Go right on into it and challenge the left that they're not really the left. they're the loony left. You got to hit them where they don't expect you to hit them. Unless you want to go right to all-out unconventional warfare, which would mean a lot of people would get hurt. And I don't think too much would come of it at this time. You see the reaction, just like here, of these whites on the street saying, oh, this is terrible, we shouldn't let them march, we shouldn't let them do that. Well, no. Back off and let the non-whites do their thing. And to where the white people there are just going to be smothered with this shit. As long as they've got an excuse to say, we're not like them. We're not like them, neo-Nazis, ultra-right-wing, ultra-ultra-right-right-right-right-right-wing. We're not like them. And then, of course, they brought the Christianity thing into it, too. So there's plenty of white people out there that aren't Christian who are in the fight. So anyhow, it goes on and on. There's always going to be somebody jump up like we've got them here. I'll lead you. First thing we're going to do is get a bunch of flags and march down the street. We'll show them. Oh, it's a sad, sad situation. I see a movie interview or a movie stringer here. It's called We Are Young, We Are Strong. I'm not sure where it was developed or not, whether it's U.S. or Europe, but it's about East Germany after the fall of the wall. The topically of We Are Young, We Are Strong is hard to miss, which is a key reason why this worthy but over-obvious fictionalization of xenophobic riots, racial riots, in 1992 Germany will hit a nerve. Burhan Qurtani's mostly black and white sophomore feature is by the book Recreation of the Buildup of the Two Nights of Violent Unrest in the Eastern Port City of Rostock, Germany, when Vietnamese immigrants become the target of disaffected residents unhappy with their own status in a recently unified Germany. Given current tensions with the other in our midst, the picture will undoubtedly gain traction at home following a late January opening. Euro screens may also beckon. Down here at the bottom it says here, things come to a head in this movie when a Roma or gypsy community is evicted next to the immigrant's housing block. An alienated youth like Sandro and Robbie are itching to flex some muscles. Meanwhile, the politicos are doing a lousy job of calming tempers, deciding it doesn't serve the message to make a preemptive evaluation of the Vietnamese community. Stefan gets swept up in the adrenaline of it all. Finally feeling some power, and one hateful night, the animalistic mob storms the apartment building with frightening results. I remember that when it was in the news. Anyhow, that's probably going to release that film in the United States, but I doubt whether they release it to many movies, movie theaters, that is. Well, keep an eye out of it. You might find it interesting, especially the riot scenes. Well, the San Diego Police Department, in my old stomping ground, is in trouble. Right there in River City. Yeah, they put they used a 1900 cartoon about cops in a training session in San Diego, and the crap is about to fly, man. Listen to this. Yeah. Well, any time now.
San Diego police sergeant suing over a racist cartoon shown during a training session.
Team 10 broke the story at midday, and now the NAACP is responding. Investigator Melissa Masiha is joining us now, and this cartoon was shown in a training session, we're told, to higher-ups.
Yeah, and it was shown in multiple classes for sergeants and lieutenants. Now, the sergeant says he tried to speak out against the cartoon, but was transferred to a different division as a result. A warning, the cartoon is offensive.
Treating other people as how you want to be treated, you know.
This is Sergeant Arthur Scott during an interview with 10 News last year. Now the 10-year veteran of the San Diego Police Department is suing over this. In the lawsuit, Scott said this cartoon from the early 1900s was used to reference Officer Frank McCarter, the first black San Diego police officer, during a training session August of last year. The cartoon shows McCarter as a monkey. The NAACP said the racist image should be shown in this story so people could see what happened in the training class. The cartoon also shows derogatory comments geared toward Asians.
The cartoon is racist.
Dr. Andre Branch of the NAACP reviewed the cartoon.
To indicate in a training examples of racism, it would be appropriate. But it would not be appropriate to simply illustrate another African-American human being.
It wasn't about, hey, you know, here's an example of despicable racism from the past. It wasn't about, hey, I want to talk about race relations and how we can't do this sort of thing.
Attorney Dan Gillian represents the sergeant. The lawsuit says when Scott complained about it, he was transferred out of the Southeastern Division, something he did not want. Scott has spoken out before. The lawsuit said in 2011 he complained about racist images of President Barack Obama in some officers' lockers. A lieutenant said he was being hypersensitive.
Obviously, the chiefs here don't particularly appreciate someone's right to speak out against racism.
It's not the first time the department was accused of racism. Last year, sources said officers complained because there were, quote, too many black faces on a mural inside San Diego's Southeastern Division station. At that time, three officers talked to Team 10 anonymously for fear of retaliation.
And just in the last 40 minutes, we got a response from Chief Shelley Zimmerman. She said they were made aware of this pending lawsuit this afternoon and that they take the allegations very seriously. They will fully cooperate and support any and all investigations. We've also reached out to local Asian American groups. We'll have their comments tonight at 7, so this is a story we definitely will be following throughout the evening. Thank you, Melissa.
All those cops that were giving me a bad time in Oceanside, California, and San Diego City. What a bunch of rotten hypocrites. That police department in San Diego has always been full of white racism. So was Oceanside. Yeah, right. We know about it. Well, let's catch up with Classy Maxie Kaiser here. He's on the run. He's down there in Mexico. Meanwhile, there's a copper carnage. The bottom is dropping out of the copper market and a whole bunch of other stuff. So, interesting. So here's old Slapsy Maxie.
Dr. Copper, he has a PhD in economics. He's telegraphing deflation. You know, it goes back to this old debate, inflation versus deflation, and the central bank's been printing lots of money, and folks have been saying, oh, we're going to see inflation. The big trend really asserting itself at the moment is deflation. Copper is crashing. Oil is crashing. Commodities are crashing. The dollar is zooming. These are all a characteristic of deflation. Now, I want to put this into context because people are confused by their day-to-day experience at the supermarket or shopping because they notice that prices are going up. And so we have to describe exactly what's going on with some finesse. The rate of price appreciation for stuff at the shops is higher than the government is stating. It's actually moving up at 6, 7, 8% in some cases in the U.S. and in the U.K. But the rate at which the global bond market, the derivatives market, the commodities market is deflating is actually greater than 7, 8, 9%. So on balance, when you add these two up together, you end up with a net deflationary environment.
And I think it's quite interesting because we've been focusing on the fact that the numbers look a lot like 2008. We've seen oil collapse. We've seen now copper collapsing. We've seen the dollar soar. It's even higher than it was in 2008. We've seen sovereign bond yields plummet. And yet the equity markets, unlike 2008, are so buoyant. I mean, we've had a few big down days, yes, and it's getting more volatile for sure. But it seems like there's a total divorce from reality, because of so much more intervention from the central banks that happens today versus 2008.
Right. Well, the stock market is still benefiting from advances in financial engineering. So when the central banks can keep rates at 0% and you add technology like high-frequency trading, algorithmic trading, which is fueled by borrowing costs that are zero, and with the knowledge that if there's any problems, the federal government will bail you out, they've applied all the mistakes of 1987, 2007, and they're applying them in greater leverage than ever before in the history of the United States or in the history of markets. So these stock market prices are the result not of earnings, not of wage growth, not of economic activity, but as the result of alchemy, pure financial alchemy that has really advanced to a level that I think even 10 years ago people thought would not be possible, that you could leverage stock markets to these extremes and to have high-frequency traders totally obliterating true price discovery with complete fake trading. You know, it's amazing that 80% of all the trades at the New York Stock Exchange are computer-generated. They never touch a human being. And much of that algorithmic trading is done by computers reading news releases that are written by other computers. So computers are writing the news. The computers are then trading on news written by computers and then responding to price action as a result of what they've just created by their own algorithmic trading that's been covered then by the algorithmic news. And you have this huge vicious loop of fraud.
Well, all the interventions has caused a mind carnage as well in the minds of investors and citizens and consumers around the world. How do you know what is what? Because everything, copper fell over 8% in one day. Copper is Dr. Copper. It's a major raw ingredient of capitalist world. How was the price so wrong the day before? How is it 8% overvalued, or is it 8% undervalued the following day? Why are these sort of huge market moves caused if it were not for all of the market intervention from the Federal Reserve, from the mainstream media propagandists, of course, telling you that everything is okay, all is great, and yet the real economy, all the numbers are telling us that we should be, you know, there's carnage in the street.
Well, there's a whole class of politicians in America and around the world and business people in America that happen to be standing on the bow of the Titanic. So as the ship is sinking, you remember the Titanic, remember it flipped and then it sunk. if you remember that movie.
Mm-hmm.
So here you have people who are the top one-tenth of 1% on the bow, I believe is the way it worked. So the Titanic has been struck with a vicious spate of deflation, and everyone in steerage is drowning to death.
Yeah.
But if you're in the bow, you see, it flipped up. Mm. So your asset prices, your Park Avenue flats are up 100%. Your Renoirs are up. Your Andy Warhols are up. Your Cristal champagne is up because you're on that part of the Titanic that just flipped up vertically.
Yeah.
But now we're at a point where glug, 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 glug. It's going to take everyone down to Davy Jones' locker in this deflationary spiral that the central banks are powerless to cure. Why? Because they won't address the problem. And the problem are the corrupt bankers. And I talk to people over and over again. They say, no, it's the politicians that are the problem. As long as politicians allow for these things to continue, there will be no end to it. We need to get rid of these politicians. I say, no, forget that, because the politicians are owned by the bankers. You need to go after the bankers. Either force them to raise rates and get rid of the zombie banks right now, or take it to the streets. Take it to the vigilante justice. Take it to where it needs to go to restore a balance to these economies. Or we're going to end up down there swimming with the fishes, dead, drowned, with nothing because we were too timid.
Well,
was that plain enough? Maybe Tom Harmon is right. He wrote a book, there'd be collapse in 2016. That's not that far off. Right on time for the national elections. Oh, brother. That'll be interesting. Gotta play a little clip from Maxi's Taxi on what's going on in Mexico right now.
Well, I'm gonna turn now to the vigilante justice happening in Mexico. And that is, death toll rises in Mexico's rolling Michoacán state. Five more members of a vigilante self-defense group were killed during the weekend in a spiral of violence sweeping parts of Mexico's troubled Michoacán state, showcased by the government in the last year as a security success story. So there's been 25 dead in the past month. But Peña Nieto, the president here, appointed one of his friends to run the place, his Alfredo Castillo. He's a federal commissioner for the state. And this is the interesting thing that is related to all the other global insurrection against banker occupation, the Diablo happening around the world, is the shootout started on, I think it was December 8th, this was the first reigniting of the shootouts between the vigilantes, the gang, the drug lords, and the police, and all sorts of people shooting at each other, right? The guy appointed by Peña Nieto to run this state, Alfredo Castillo, was spotted in the posh area of Mexico City called Polanco, at a Rolex shop. So it reminded me so much of just being in Hong Kong only 2 weeks ago, and the same thing happening there, is that the people are realizing they're behind the Hollywood gloss. They see the carnage in the real markets, the real economy, what's really happening, and yet they see these people living like Hollywood movie stars as if nothing touches them, that they always have, you know, post-production on their face wherever they go. And it's something that we saw happening in China, where the people are angry with people wearing Gucci, well, politicians wearing Gucci belts and things like that.
Right. So this idea of increasing the CCTV cameras will give the state additional power. They fail to understand the equation here is that people with their smartphones become a massive vigilante justice team or army of vigilantes who see the Rolex watch shopping corrupt politicians, or to see the corrupt politicians in Hong Kong. So, you know, they can put up 10 more CCTV cameras, and the vigilantes on the street are going to put up 100 more images of these corrupt politicians lying to the public. So this is not like a war that's not going to be won ultimately by the vigilantes, because throughout history, the corrupt state has always failed in the end. The corrupt state has always failed in the end. So now we're at the end game, and now the vigilantes, the global insurrection against banker occupation, are now on the march.
Now, the other interesting thing is that there's a lot of debate happening whether or not these vigilantes are a good or a bad thing, because nobody else is going to protect them from the drug lords backed by the U.S., so they're going out there and taking them on themselves. Now, who has come out in support of them but the Catholic Church? The vigilante movement is understandable. Understandable that they are fed up and want justice and to be able to defend themselves, says Alberto Suarez, Archbishop of Morelio, the Michoacan capital, who is part of a new crop of cardinals being elevated next month. So the cardinal here representing this state is backing the vigilante, saying, yes, it makes sense that the injustice leads to this. We've said that before. Injustice always leads to this. We've talked about the French Revolution started because it was injustice.
Right. Well, you know, the Pope, this new Pope, is elevating a whole bunch of cardinals that are taking stands in this way. And it makes perfect sense that the church would be behind the vigilantes because they're on the side of righteousness in this struggle against global insurrection, against banker occupation. So they know where their bread is buttered because they want to be down with the people in the end.
That's a very interesting development that the Catholic Church is getting involved in northern Mexico. And I think it's good because it's going to give these vigilantes more to go on. Amen. The church is supporting us. Let's kick their ass. So I think you're going to see a very lively intercourse of bullets in northern Mexico now. The scene that drew residents of Central Park Avenue just south of Foster Avenue to their front porches on August 16, 1921 in Chicago was eerily reminiscent of the Birth of the Nation, the film that celebrated the night-riding vigilantes who restored white supremacy to post-Civil War South. Thousands of men in white gowns and hoods exchanged ritual handshakes and piled into long lines of cars headed for a secret destination in the northern suburbs. But while director D.W. Griffith's 1915 movie commemorating a Ku Klux Klan moribund for half a century, the procession that formed on an Albany Park neighborhood street marked its rebirth and its expansion. The original Klan had targeted African Americans. Newly freed from bondage, it became obsolete once Jim Crow laws established the segregated South. Yeah. Where am I at here? Where am I at? I lost my place. The new Klan enlarged the compass of its feelings, preaching that immigrants, sometimes Catholics, and Jews were undermining the American way of life. Interestingly enough, at a time when a lot of Catholics were not allowed in the Klan, there were Jews let in the Klan. Chicago, the preeminent city of immigrants, was a natural recruiting ground for older stock Protestant Americans, fearful of losing their place at the top of the pecking order to Catholics and Jews. Our membership is limited to native-born American Gentiles, William Simmons, the Klan's imperial wizard, told the Tribune, Chicago Tribune. For the Klan, Chicago was the key to transforming the Southern organization into a national movement. So Simmons came from his Atlanta headquarters to personally lead the procession that assembled 94 years ago on Central Park Avenue. When the caravan had reached its destination near U.S. 12 and the old Rand Road, new members of the Chicago Klan were put through a ritual called naturalization. The next day's Tribune reported a huge bonfire had been lighted. Thousands of members of the order, which bearing aloft a torch, took position in the form of a blazing cross. The blindfolded initiates were herded inside, the paper reported. Upon the weird assemblage, the searchlights of the automobiles drawn about in a great assembly shone with white intensity. Pickets patrolled beyond the pale, terrifying the curious citizens of the countryside by their grotesque appearances. The restored KKK membership wasn't limited to the lower middle class, the traditional breeding ground of the xenophobic political movements. That mass initiation ceremony was held on a farm near Lake Zurich owned by Charles Wiegman, whose string of cheap loop restaurants had made him a millionaire. Wiegman built the North Side Ballpark, subsequently known as Wrigley Field, and owned the Cubs from 1916 to 1918. Perhaps he was among the business leaders attracted to the KKK for its hostility to the union movement. which the Klan equated with Bolsheviks, who recently seized power in Russia, a powerful argument during a wave of bitter strikes in America. See, that's where I get off the track with the KKK, when they were anti-union. And they're a lot like the Tea Party today, because they weren't doing hardly any violence. But I would equate the Klan of the 20s with the Tea Party today. Maybe a little bit more militant, but not much. There was hardly any murders or lynchings going on during that period, especially in the North. So anyhow, that's a little bit from years gone by in Chicago, Illinois. I just put a note on the email section of the Chicago Tribune. Too bad the Chicago didn't remain racially like the Klan wanted it to. We'll see how long that stays up. Well, here's another Chicago story. 50 years ago today, January 24th, 1965, England was grieving the death of Winston Churchill, the man credited for bringing the nation through the great, stupid, capitalistic war. And in America, another great war was taking place, the battle for equal rights. I told you there is no such thing for black Americans, so it'll never end. And in New Bern, one of the violent battles was taking place. It happened like this. St. Peter's AME Zionist Church had been center of civil rights since its inception shortly after the Civil War. By founder James Walker Hood. On this day in 1965, the church was the scene of a five-county rally of the NAACP. The main speakers of the night were Julius Levon Chambers, a civil rights activist. Chambers, 1936 to 2013, is best known for his work with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. That was back when I think Kivi Kaplan was running the NAACP, a Jew. In 1965, he was the director of the law firm representing the NAACP North Carolina chapter. His name not only drew a crowd of NAACP members from across the region, it also pricked the ears of exalted Cyclops Raymond Mills, leader of the Ku Klux Klan Clavern, the New Bern branch of the KKK. Mills contacted fellow Klansman Laurie Fingelgame, 21, and Edward Fillingame, 23, armed with sticks of dynamite. The men climbed into Mills' red Plymouth and drove from their home to Vanceboro to New Bern. Well, let's see here. New Bern Police Detective John Pate was parked on Queen Street when he heard an explosion at 8:35 p.m. He drove towards the sound and arrived at Johnson and Metcalf Streets near the church, where he found a 1962 Rambler had been dynamited. Well, a 62 Rambler should have been dynamited. Almost immediately, a second explosion went off. A Sun Journal reporter of the trial, which took place 6 months later, stated that the Rambler raised off the ground and he saw the hubcaps come flying off into the street. As one might expect, the church doors opened and the people poured out. The Plymouth was owned by Chambers. Quote, "I went outside and looked to see what had happened," he said in a Charlotte Observer interview years later. "They had put dynamite in my gas pipe." Wow. That was back when the Klan was, you know, pretty feisty. The explosion had put a hole in the back of his car, destroying his gas tank and blowed his license plate off. "There was nothing one could do," he recalled. "We decided to continue with the meeting." The other car was owned by Jones County NAACP Director Carolina B. Chadwick. A Sun Journal article appearing on January 25th, the day after the event, reported an estimate damage of $150 to Chadwick's car and $250 to Chambers. Doesn't sound like a big explosion to me. While police were still on the scene, they heard the distant boom of a third blast. Dynamite had gone off at Oscar's mortuary on Oscar Drive near Pembroke Road, tearing up a concrete driveway and breaking glass in an ambulance shed. Police notified the SBI and the FBI to investigate, and it wasn't long before Mills and Fillingame, cousins, had arrest warrants placed in their hands. Wow. A small article appeared on page one of the Sun Journal the next day, almost obscured by coverage of Churchill. Within days, however, the story became a national event, appearing in newspapers across the country. The national coverage, the Daily Times News of Burlington, quoted W.C. Chadwick, the white president of the New Bern's Biracial Race Relations Council. Yeah, they were in high gear even back then, as saying it was a big shock and uncalled for. I don't believe anyone in town would have done it. Governor Rhodes, the local NAACP president, added that up until now, the lack of bombing seemed to be going pretty fair, but they put people on edge. They don't know what's and what now. Yeah. Famous but incompetent agents arrested an exalted Cyclops of the Ku Klux Klan and two other men, according to the Anderson, Indiana Daily Bulletin. On January 29, the article spoke of Ku Klux Klan robes, minutes, and application blanks being collected at Mills' home. It also referred to a Klan charter issued by the Imperial Wizard Robert Shelton of Tuscaloosa, Alabama, naming Mills as exalted Cyclops of the local organization. They were charged with federal crime of violating the civil rights of Chambers, Chadwick, and Oscar Dove, an NAACP member who owned the mortuary. On a local level, they were charged with conspiracy and the violating of the state's bombing laws. The trial. By the time it came to trial, the federal charges were dropped. Well, that's interesting. The U.S. Attorney Robert Cohen took a dismissal of the federal charges before the U.S. Commissioner Ellen G. Howard, so the trio could be tried in Superior Court, according to the May 31, 1965 article in the Sun Journal. That same day, a three-day trial began under the Superior Court Judge Albert Cowper from Kingston. Mills and Fillingame denied the charges for a time, but surprised the court on the final day by pleading guilty to two counts of violating bombing laws. In exchange for the plea, the state dropped the charges of bombing, the mortuary, and conspiracy. Cooper gave the three men suspended sentences and placed them on 3 years probation and ordered them to pay court costs. Mills was further ordered to make restitution to Chambers and Chadwick. Although both the bombing and the trial were reported nationally on AP and UPI news wires and was credited with stirring up further unrest across North Carolina, the 50 years since its occurrence seems to have faded in memory in the city. Few of the locals approached had more than a vague recollection of the day. Well, you see, the Klan had a lot of sympathy back then, and it's obviously because the feds dropped their charges. And they pled guilty and just got suspended sentences and probation. Boy, that wouldn't happen today, I'll tell you.
We are hearing from a Ku Klux Klan leader about literature the group distributed in Galax. I told you about some people being troubled by the pamphlets left on their doorstep that criticized Martin Luther King Jr. WDBJ7 Frankie Jupiter is here with a follow-up this evening.
That's right, Gene. James Moore is the Grand Dragon state leader for Virginia with the Loyal White Knights of the KKK. He says the pamphlets weren't meant as hate towards anybody. He says the literature is part of a national recruitment. Now, some people did not welcome the literature, calling it offensive. Moore says he wanted to put what he calls out the truth about Martin Luther King. Now, the flyers call King a communist pervert. It states he used money for civil rights to hire white prostitutes.
Now, I've looked at the news article myself, and people are complaining, saying we targeted them. We're not targeting anybody. We're practicing our First Amendment rights, getting our side of the story out. These are all facts and not fiction. This is FBI records that Martin Luther King was a card-carrying communist as well as a pervert.
Now, I asked Moore if he had any proof of these accusations. He says the government continues to keep these records sealed. Frankie Jupiter, WDBJ 7.
The oil spill near Williston, North Dakota, means that the chickens have come home to roost. I've been writing letters to some of those papers in North Dakota telling them that our environment's being destroyed by these greedy bastard oil people and the whole bit, and they're going to ruin your environment. Well, now it's happening, so we'll see what happens. I may put a big billboard up on my lot there in Leith that you were worried about Craig Cobb. You better worry about the oil people and their greed. Yep, that's what I may do. Well, look what's happening here. The anti-Islamist group American Freedom Defense Initiative is running ads on 50 San Francisco public buses that feature a photo of a prominent World War II-era Palestinian leader meeting with Hitler. The photo of Hitler with Haj Aman al-Husseini, the Mufti of Jerusalem, who violently opposed Zionism, urged the Arabs of the pre-state Israel to kill Jews and help create the culture of jihad, is captioned, quote, "Islamic Jew hatred, it's in the Quran." The ads, which will run for 4 weeks, appeared on the Muni buses following the January 7th terrorist attack in Paris on the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, that left 12 dead and the murder of 4 Jews in a kosher supermarket 2 days later. Abby Michelson Porth, associate director of the San Francisco-based Jewish Community Relations Council, said, quote, "We do not believe that an advertisement on the side of the bus is useful or approximate vehicle for discussing appropriate the very real threats of anti-Semitism and radical Islamization." Ibram Hooper, spokesman for the New York-based Council on American Islamic Relations, told Reuters that his group had countered past efforts by AFDI to place anti-Islam messages on public buses, but would not do so at this time. Inflammatory ads sponsored by the AFDI, a New York-based group led by Pamela Geller, appeared on San Francisco buses in October and last year on New York and in New York and Washington. A statement by the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency cited the First Amendment protection of freedom of speech, including speech that was considered offensive. In explaining why it accepted the ads, it also said it did not want to use taxpayers' dollars to defend itself against a potential lawsuit. Well, there you go. So, of all the posters advertising plays, there is one that sticks out more than any other. It's a picture of two men and a woman beating the hell out of each other. Above them is the bold, unmissable lettering, is the play's title, quote, "Bad Jews." Nobody suggested I change it, says the 31-year-old New York playwright Joshua Heyman. But I was afraid they were going to. I know that the title offends some people. I've had hate mail. There's an irony here. If we assume that the people who sent these letters were Jews who find the title offensive, then they are also among the people most likely to enjoy Heyman's play, set in a desirable New York apartment overlooking the Hudson River. Heyman's comedy is populated by a family who have come together to the funeral of Pop, their grandfather, a Holocaust survivor. The main conflict is between cousins, Lam Goodman and Daphne, played by Jennifer Auger, who has picked up an award for her performance during the play in the United Kingdom's premiere at the Ustinov Theater in Bath last year. Well, so there you can go see a play that describes Jews as bad Jews. Sorry about that. I had my mic turned down. New York State's most powerful Jewish power broker has fallen. The city awoke Thursday morning to a political world turned inside out. Sheldon Silver, among the two or three most powerful men in state politics since 1994, surrendered to the FBI agents in the early hours of the morning at Federal Building in Foley Square, just blocks from the Lower East Side district he dominated for decades. Quote, "I hope I'll be vindicated," Silver said as he entered FBI custody, according to the New York Times. Well, several of his boys and partners in crime are going to jail, man. And one of them even took off for Israel and said, "I ain't coming back there." Okay. That's it for today. Sorry for that last gap in the show. Anyhow, I'll be back tomorrow. No, I won't be back tomorrow. Tomorrow's my day off. I can sit out here on the back porch, and if the sun's out, I can revere the sun. Yes, that's right, the All-Father. 14:05, and I have nothing to say now, because the show's over. Bye.